Welcome to Your Family Dog, a podcast dedicated to helping families love living with dogs. Here are your hosts, Julie Fudge-Smith and Colleen Pilar.
Hi, and welcome to Your Family Dog. I'm Julie Fudge-Smith, and I'm here with Colleen Pilar, and we have a very, very special guest today, Mrs. Madeline Bernstein. She is the president of the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, Los Angeles. She served as the president of the board of directors for the California Animal Welfare Association. It's the unified voice of California's animal care and control agencies. She was the first distinguished visiting animal advocate for the Center for Animal Law Studies at Lewis and Clark College. And prior to joining the ASPCA LA, she was the Deputy Inspector General Advocate for the New York City Department of Ports and Terminals and a former Assistant District Attorney for the Bronx District Attorney's Office. She's a graduate of the State University of New York at Buffalo, Faculty of Law and Jurisprudence. So not only does she have a wonderful background in animals, she also has a law degree, which makes her especially qualified to be able to assess some of the things that happen in the dog world that we're going to be discussing. So thank you for joining us, Madeline. Oh, and the other thing is, probably the one reason we invited her on, I forgot to mention, she has a brand new book out called Designer Dogs, an Exposé, Inside the Criminal Underworld of Crossbreeding, a very timely and important book, which I have read and found it to be an easy book to read, but a hard book to read because Madeline is unflinching in her account of what happens in puppy mills and other unsavory parts of the dog world. So with that introduction, Colleen, I believe you have the first question for Madeline.
I do. This weekend I saw a cartoon and there was a man standing next to a curly dog and he said, I thought I was getting a poodle doodle, but it turns out a poodle doodle is just a regular poodle. And it does seem like labradoodles and oodles and doodles and all of the things are everywhere these days. And a while back, I read an article in which the man who originally started crossbreeding poodles and Labradors in Australia said he really didn't, he wasn't really delighted that had taken off the way it had. So can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. I just want to say one thing, though, to correct. We're not the Los Angeles ASPCA. The ASPCA is a New York organization. Oh. Has nothing to do with any ASPCA in the country. We're all okay. Legally different. There's no chapters. Not connected.
Right. Okay. My bad.
It's all right. You know, they'd shoot me if I let that stand.
And that's how we know she's also a lawyer.
Well, and who knows if the ASPCA agrees with anything I'm about to say. That's the other thing.
That's right. So ASPCA LA.
Right. So Wally Conran originally, and the entire story is in the book, but in the 80s, he was trying to solve a problem. He was breeding guide dogs. And those in Australia were typically Labradors. And he had a request for a guide dog from a couple where one had a sight problem, but the other was allergic to dogs. And so he thought, you know, let me see if I can figure something out. And so what he did is he mixed a Labrador with a poodle, because although some of the myths I bust in the book, one of which is there are no hypoallergenic dogs, there are some different dog hairs that are easier on allergy sufferers than others. And so at the time, he sent hair and fiber samples to the couple to see out of the puppies, and he did two litters worth of puppies before they found one dog and then a couple of others within the two breeds that didn't upset the allergy as much as a normal dog. So he then took that dog, which he bred, to one of the foster parents and people that house the guide dogs while they're in training. He said that they wouldn't foster a mutt, that they would only foster a pedigree. And again, this is Australia in the 80s. I don't know that you'd have that bias now. So as a marketing scheme and an effort to get the dog placed, he said, I've invented a new breed called the Labradoodle. And then they said, oh, well, in that case, we'll foster it. So from that really started this epidemic of these kinds of intentionally mixed breed dogs. They're all mutts, no matter how much you pay for them. They're mutts, right? And I guarantee you, while some Labradoodles are wonderful, and I'm sure some of your viewers have Labradoodles and love them and are wonderful to them, I wonder how many of them got hair and fiber, you know, hair and saliva samples before they selected their dog. But what happens is, with every good thing, the bad people come out, and they began indiscriminately just mixing. And then taking the mixes and mixing. And so what you ended up with was the worst genetic problems from each dog recessively thrown forward into some of these dogs, which is why he absolutely regrets that he did that now and is apologetic all over the place.
Yeah. My question is always, why didn't he just offer them a poodle? You know, why did you have to do the Labradoodle? Poodles can make wonderful service dogs, and that would have solved perhaps the problem, but that's neither here nor there.
Right.
So you just touched on a little bit about one of the problems with these mixing of breeds and mixing of breeds is people say this to me all the time. Well, it's got a poodle in it, so it's got to be hyperallergenic. And I'm like, you know, it's not that straightforward, folks. I mean, what if you didn't get that part of the poodle mix? What if you got that part is the Labrador mix? So can you talk a little bit more about what the problem is with designer dogs and the idea of trying to move these genetics forward and some of the problems that happen when you do that?
Well, right. I mean, the best story, you know, we all learned in school about hemophilia and the royal family, right? So right. When relatives continue to marry each other and produce offspring, the recessive genes start to come forward because then both are carriers and then it just gets worse and worse. Well, the same thing happens with dogs too. So if you have a Labrador with hip dysplasia and a congenital problem with poodles and you keep mixing them forward, eventually you're going to get a dog with a lot of problems. There are ethical breeders in the world and responsible breeders. And we talk about that in the book and how you locate
them. You do.
The problem is the demand for these dogs has reached such epidemic proportions that the ethical breeders can't keep up with the demand. And so you see people selling these dogs in the back of pickup trucks. And very often, you know, these types of designer mixes, the teacup dogs, all these dogs, very often they don't last 48 hours. I mean, it's not just a problem here. It's a problem right now all over the place. And basically we're saying you get the dog for Christmas and the dog doesn't survive till New Year's because of all these. There are liver diseases, blood diseases, congenital brain disorders, all of these things, some of them don't even manifest until the dog is like a year old. So if you want a dog like that, you know, find an ethical, responsible breeder and work there. Because when you diminish the diversity of the gene pool, then all you get are the same genes over and over. And in these puppy mills, they're not genetic experts, I can tell you that. And they're using the same mother over and over and the same dogs over and over. And there's other issues involved in debilitating the health of both the parents and the puppies. And why do you want that? Why would anyone want a dog that, like that?
Right. One of the things that was really interesting that you talked about is the trend now towards teacup dogs, tiny dogs. And the problem with that, people are like, well, what's the problem with that? Just because the dog is small and can fit in my purse. Well, there's a lot of problems because they're bred from runts. And runts are the ones that tend to have more of the problems. And so it's just compounding exactly what you were saying, is taking dogs that have the worst traits of their particular breed and breeding them with other dogs that have the worst traits of their particular breed as well.
That's right. And they're super fragile. Sometimes they're literally just too little to survive. Their lungs, their heart hasn't fully formed.
Right.
Their brains haven't fully formed. And you could put them in your purse and fracture a bone just by jostling. And there's no breed called teacup. Again, marketing.
Right.
I mean, God, you know, we're all suckers for the most adorable dog, you know,
right.
Keeping out of
yes.
Right. But we have, these teacup breeders that, you know, are just going smaller and smaller. Also, a lot of these people are con artists. So some people have bought what they were told was a teacup and basically got the runt of the litter and turned out to be a big dog.
Right.
You know, and again, they're not recognized as breeds by anywhere. They're not even recognized as toy breeds anywhere.
Right.
But the idea is to get them smaller and smaller and smaller. And if they're sitting on your lap and they land on the floor, very often they can fracture a whole lot of
stuff.
That's
right.
Yeah.
It's a travesty. Yeah. It's just a travesty.
No, those are the worst.
They are truly the worst. So how did this demand for designer dogs get started other than the Labradoodles? It seems to me that you had people like, oh, that's a great idea. Get all the wonderful benefits of a retriever and none of the hair problems. But how did it explode into the epidemic that we have today?
Well, for one thing, everyone got the idea. Everyone decided they were God or Frankenstein and decided to make their own creations to get the funniest faces, the funniest colors. Gee, could I have a blue, you know, French, a blue, you know, Frenchie. There's an albino pink pug that was just created in the UK. Wow. So people just thought, gee, the bulging eyes make everybody laugh. Maybe I can get a dog, you know, with more bulging eyes, you know, than any other dog in the world. So people started to do that and create these Instagram-worthy dogs, and with the ability to point and click and have a dog like that immediately appear on your doorstep, it just went crazy. Plus, you know, here in Los Angeles, I mean, you've got the celebrity factor.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, as it is, when any kind of dog is in a movie, whether it's 101 Dalmatians, where we are drowning here in Los Angeles, where it's 87 degrees outside. I have shelters full of Huskies right now because of the popularity of Game of Thrones. In fact, we just got a stray wolf dog in yesterday.
Wow.
That was clearly designed for that. So it's bad enough that whether it's Snoopy or 101 Dalmatians mm-hmm. or Game of Thrones or Lassie or what, you know, that people want to have the dog that's on TV, the famous dog, or what the celebrities are carrying, this idea of intentionally mixing breeds like that to get something unique, it just took off. It just absolutely took off. And it's at a fever pitch. And they're being smuggled and they're being trafficked and they're, you know, those conditions are horrible too. Yesterday's Daily Mail, which is a UK paper, they just talked about how they're getting dogs into the UK, smuggled in from Hungary, but they're making 28 million pounds. So
it's not
a profession that is not lucrative. So you take that and the public's demand, and guess what? I mean, it's like a drug enterprise.
Mm-hmm.
And the high wears off very quickly. Once people get some of these dogs and they realize they're too expensive, their medical bills are expensive, or the novelty wears off, or they pee all over the purse, then the shelters end up getting them, or they're abandoned on the streets, or they're resold and they're cheating someone else who's buying them. And there's just a lot of crime involved in this whole process and a lot of conning the public. And I say, as the public, we can fight back. And that's why, you know, part of rewriting this book was to say, we can fight back, we can fix this, and we can stop it. So if you know about it, we can stop it.
So tell us a little bit about that. So how can we take action?
Well, first, we have to reduce the demand, right? So we can reduce the demand by saying, you know what, I don't want these dogs. I'm going to adopt the most unusual, the most unique, the original designer dogs that are at the shelters everywhere, right? They're one of a kind. So the first thing we can do is reduce the demand. Just say no. Use your power to say no and your purchase power to start to dry up the supply. We try to, like with a program such as Air Chihuahua, that we created years ago, rather than having people who live in, our first one was with Colorado. So in Colorado, they have shelters with no little dogs. Here in Los Angeles, we're drowning in purse dogs and chihuahuas. Again, you know, the Taco Bell Chihuahua, the movies about Chihuahuas, Legally Blonde. I mean, you see the problem. So we're drowning in those dogs and they have none. So we literally put a plane load of Chihuahuas and other little dogs in Hawaiian shirts and we send them to Colorado, where they were immediately adopted because we did media with the Denver Friends League in Colorado. And so as a result, there were lines waiting at the shelter for when the Los Angeles dogs came in and they immediately got homes. So we're trying to find out what consumers really want. And with 60 million dogs in the shelters, chances are we have them. And so we've been working for years with other organizations that are credible to try to move the existing dogs around to meet the supply so that that person doesn't go on the internet and go, ooh, you know, Chihuahua, point and click, when we have zillions of them.
So I have a question about that, too, from the perspective of if, you know, if I go to the shelter and I know that I want, you know, a smaller dog, how could I tell as an adopter whether this is a dog who maybe has a puppy mill background versus not? Is there a way
you
to
can't.
Tell that? You can't, see?
You can't, unless we know, you know, unless... So if the dog comes in off the streets, we don't know. And if someone surrenders a dog and says, you know, I paid $3,000 for this dog, and we will tell adopters that. Then we know, because we'll tell an adopter whatever we know. My Pomeranian Winter, who I talk about in the book a little, is definitely, I mean, you can tell she was of a puppy mill because she has, you know, the top 10 problems associated with that. But she ended up in the shelter. She was a stray. She was probably thrown out because she has all her problems. And, you know, she ended up with me. So I have one purely organic, original designer, big yellow dog. Then we have the Pomeranian, you know, who I just... had to make well. But so you can't. What you have to watch out for are even rescue groups or other organizations that will sanitize the records. So you adopt, we will tell you this dog has seizures, this dog is diabetic, this dog, you know, has all these things, particularly since we take animals in, we seize animals in cruelty cases, because we're a law enforcement power. We know a lot of these dogs that have come from puppy mills, we seize them from puppy mills. We also know how they've been treated, and we warn the adopters. This dog was very badly emaciated, was beaten, may have brain damage from repeated blows to the head. We will tell the adopter that. I don't have a pleasant thought in my head.
Well, are there certain things that people should be looking for that would be a sign to them that this is a poorly bred dog and maybe you shouldn't go down this path? I think that there are husbandry issues such as parasites, dysentery, fleas, bladder infections, parvo, those kinds of things which say that the dog was not husbanded well. But I think there's also genetic defects. I mean, the particularly, you know, googly eyes, you got to be really careful because those eyes actually fall out of the head. And Colleen was about to pass out. So when she revived.
Years ago, when Julie first read that piece of information in a book, she said it to one of her daughters. And her daughter said, note to self, must have snout, as her like advice for herself adopting a dog forever. So whenever I think about the googly eyed dogs, I see Ellie going, must have snout, note to self, must have snout,
right.
Must have snout.
Right.
And eye popping out is about as bad as it can get.
Yeah, right. It's terrifying. I mean, it's happened at the shelter, you know. It's like, wait a minute, what just happened here? Oh, it's okay. It's all right. Yeah, we got this. Like, I don't got this.
Yeah. So the other thing is I think that people also kind of need to understand is one of the things, like, I will have people who will come to me, they'll call me because they've been up to Amish country here in Ohio, or they have been to a local shelter and suddenly they have this dog with all kinds of problems. And when they start talking, they can say one of two things. It's a small dog that was, and boom, I know that we have problems. But one of the things that I tell people is that even if you are buying from a breeder, such as one in Amish country, one of the key things for me is to take a close look at that contract. Because if the contract stipulates that this dog is non-returnable for any reason, you should walk away as quickly as you can. Because any reputable breeder, if there's any problem whatsoever with their dog, they want it back.
Right.
They want their dogs and they want them back. And to me, that is just probably the single most thing I can take a look at a contract that tells me that this is not a reputable breeder. Is there something else?
Well, that's assuming that that's even real, because what we have, I get these calls all the time where they buy a dog, you know, from the back of a pickup truck, or they walk into some place and they're given a contract, or they're given a cell phone number, which turns out to be a burner phone. We have a case pending now where they do call, they are told they could have their money back, and they're either told they could have a different dog, which has the exact same problems because they're from the same litter, or they're left with a burner phone and nothing.
Right.
And so I would say that sometimes even the contract, if they're, you know, it's not going to help you. If you're living in your neck of the woods and you're at those Amish puppy mills, and you're there where you can carry on, maybe. But there was a case, I was sitting in someone's living room and they had a bulldog that they imported from Missouri. The dog arrived with terrible pneumonia. They spent $5,000 right off the bat on medical bills, not counting the price of the dog, which was about $3,000 or $4,000. To fix the pneumonia, they called the puppy mill, and it was a puppy mill, and they were told basically tough, that we don't have to pay for the medical bills. Then the dog developed irritable bowel syndrome, and that was another few thousand dollars because the colon twisted. That was emergency surgery. And then while we're sitting there on a 100-degree day, you know, doing something that's not related at all to the dog or this book or anything, it was just a business meeting, the dog was overheating and stressing out because
he can't breathe.
Without the snout, right, and a debilitating condition, the dog was not even able to handle being a little excited that there was company and began to overheat. So from Los Angeles to Missouri, they were told to get lost. Mm-hmm. And so right. I don't know if the contract is really worth the paper, it's printed on in some cases.
Well, and we right. often have clients, too, where they say, oh, they will trade me for another dog. But first off, now I'm attached to this one. Like, I'm emotionally invested in this one. And what's going to happen to this one if I give it back? And then what's going to happen if I get another one with all the same problems? And okay. it's this whole emotional level that's so mean to the adopters.
Well, right. And what do you tell this? What do you tell your children? Mm-hmm. You know, right. I'm returning this dog. Well, the first thing most children will think is, if I get sick, if I get the flu, will you return me? You know, so, you know, there's this whole thing that, you know, we're trying to mentor people to be mindful and do the right thing in the world, whether it's animals, planets, you know, our planet or person to person. And so nobody wants to hear me talk. But if my kids saw me, you know, turn my back on something that I committed to care for, they would learn a lesson that you don't ever want a child to learn. And so, you know, it the texture of this is multidimensional, just in terms of what is, you know, the high price you paid for this cute dog. And, you know, also realize that if you can't go see the conditions that the dog is in, you really shouldn't buy a dog there. That's why if you know of an ethical breeder and you don't have to have immediate gratification, the minute you wake up in the morning and think, I want, you know, a cockapoo and have to have it by 5 that day. Like, if you can be an adult about this and just say, okay, let's think about it. Because you might find a reputable breeder, an ethical breeder nearby, and the book tells you how to identify them and what to expect. The breeder will tell you, I don't have a litter. Now I'm expecting one in 3 months. Can you wait? And part of the problem with pointing and clicking is that we can't wait as a society. we can't wait. And what message is that that you're sending to your kids mm-hmm. when they're watching this process? So you have people bypassing the physical locations of where they might get these dogs and pointing and clicking. And very often the dog that you've seen on the internet is not the dog that shows up at your door. And so there's all sorts of bait and switch issues and misleading advertising. So I would say, love any dog you have, look for any dog you want, but do it responsibly. And that's why I think while there are hard to see things in the book, the book tells you how to get the dog you want and love the dog you want and not contribute to this nonsense.
Right. And I think that, the thing we have to bear in mind is that even if you get one of these dogs, these are not dogs that we want to breed because of the continuing issues that they have. So there's a balance between wanting to shut down these puppy mills, right, and not produce these dogs that have physical, emotional, or behavioral problems for their entire lives. But we also do have to support reputable breeders because we also need good dogs for families. Right. And so I think your statement there is if you can find one in the shelter that meets your needs, that's fabulous. But if you definitely, you know, you want a particular breed or you want a particular kind of dog, then you have to do the responsible thing and work with a reputable breeder, put your name on the waiting list or whatever it may be, because we also need to have good dogs. We can't just, you know, stop the flow of puppy mill dogs. We need to start substituting them with good dogs so people begin to understand this is a great dog. This is what I need to be looking for.
Well, and the breeding, I mean, with French bulldogs and a lot of these other, you know, pugs and other such dogs, they were bred constantly to reduce their rear, you know, their rear and mm-hmm. have the big funny head. So those dogs can't even breed, you know, they can't even breed.
Wrong.
Right. And so there's an ethical question, even in the veterinary community, like, should we even assist in making more of those dogs? Because, you know, we've designed the shape, we've changed the dog mm-hmm. Completely and basically rendered the dog. It's almost like the dog is saying, you know what, I'm going extinct now and you can't stop me, you know, because I'm out. I've had it.
A while back, I saw some photos comparing the breed winners from 50 years ago with the breed winner more recently. And it was fascinating to see how the dogs really just didn't even look at all the same. Right. And the words hadn't changed that much. But the tastes had changed of what, you know, the sloping German Shepherd with the hind legs and the hocks all tucked under and the bulldogs with the smaller rear ends and the big old heads. Right. And you're like, oh, that's not helpful. This is not natural selection. This is us playing God.
Right. Exactly. And even with collies. You know, collies used to have much shorter snouts and rounder heads. And now they've got these needle nose things that are just, it's just terrible. Right. And I think that people don't understand that if you breed towards a particular trait, like you breed towards a needle-nosed collie or you breed towards a bulgy-headed French coat or a Frenchie, what you're going to have is genetics play out in different ways, that you're always going to have unintended consequences if you're breeding for a singular trait.
Right.
And you know, it could be that you're going to increase their chances for, you know, some sort of cancer or with the French bulldogs, we can't breed anymore. And it's just insane.
Because these people who really want to capitalize on the public demand and make a lot of money, quickly from this, they're not genetic experts and they're not concerned about gene diversity. Whereas, again, your ethical breeder, very often they're doing testing before they sell the dog, because there are certain things, even with a diverse gene pool and even with, you know, a proper nourishment and proper husbandry, sometimes things happen. I mean, people, so there's ways to help reduce a surprise when you do get a dog, but they're not doing that in these large, they're like factory farms for dogs.
Right. And the fact is that any reputable breeder is not making a whole lot of money off their dogs because they're doing everything that they need to take care of the bitch right. and the litter and the right. the veterinary care and the genetic testing and right. all the other stuff that they do. They're not making much money off their dogs.
No.
And they're certainly not in it to make money. They're in it because of the love of the breed in and general.
Half the time, the contract that they give you is more about them being worried about you.
Yes.
as being, because I mean, so that's why, you know, this is not, and the reputable breeders and the ethical breeders don't like this either, you know?
No, they don't.
So very often they're, if they love that their particular breed that they're working with and they love their dogs and they're investing money to care for the dogs, they don't want to hand it over to somebody who's going to harm the dog. Also, in a lot of states, there's mandatory spay neuter laws. So very often you might go to an ethical breeder for a dog and that dog will come to you spay or neutered because it also prevents you from then deciding, well, I just paid $5,000 for this dog. I can do this too if I sell three in a week. And do you think they're paying taxes? No. I mean, you know, these backyard breeders and the, you know, they're not the ethical business people. There's all sorts of laws being broken. So that also stops it. And so you can, the breeder, if you're worried about the spaying and the neutering and you're pitching a fit about that and the breeder's explaining to you that either it's a preference or a law, that tells the breeder something too. Mm-hmm. So you
absolutely
may not get the dog. So it's good that both sides are evaluating the process and understanding what's involved because this is a big commitment. I mean, a dog is a commitment for, you know, 15, 20 years sometimes. I mean, it's, mm-hmm. it's, you know, mm-hmm. it's not a bag of chips.
Yeah. Well, we really appreciate you coming on to talk to us about this issue because it is, it's a really tough issue to wrestle with. And it just seems so big and discouraging at times. So it's encouraging to hear that you think there are things that can be done. And I want to be in line for the next Air Chihuahua line. I may have to drive out to Colorado to be there, but that just sounds fun to me.
Well, we've been doing it all across the country. When the match is right, we send the plane. So great. Who knows, you might be in your place.
I will keep track.
I also want to mention Madeline's book once again. It's called Designer Dogs, an expose inside the criminal underworld of crossbreeding. You can get it on Amazon.com. And I highly recommend you take a look at it. My lawyer husband started reading it and he's like, this is really a good book. And I'm like, so you could, he said, I said, she mentions a lot of statutes. He goes, really? That's pretty cool. So,
yeah, I figured that the lawyers or the people involved in legislation always like sample statutes. So
they don't have to
reinvent the wheel to try to get a law passed. So I stuck that in. My mother said, well, I get the lawyers will like some of this. I'm just skipping the statutes.
And you're like, and that's why they're set aside so that you can skip them.
That's right.
Feel free. Skip the statue.
Well, we'll put links in our show notes to that so that people can find it very easily. And we're so grateful that you came on today.
Well, thanks for inviting me. This was fun.
That's fun.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to Your Family Dog. Got questions? Interesting ideas? Colleen and Julie would love to hear them. Call 614-349-1661 or visit www.yourfamilydogpodcast.com to share your thoughts.